Today's sermon comes from the Church of the Larger Fellowship by Reverend Judith A. Walker Riggs. And I didn't really find out who she was or when she wrote this. This is you'll notice that some of the dates are a little older, and there's a lot of British references in here. But I enjoyed this sermon, and I hope you do as well. The Royal Society for the Prevention of Accidents held an exhibition at Harrogate in 1978. The entire display fell down. This is a sermon for all of you who have read all those books on how to be a success, and for all of you who haven't read them, but know deep down in your hearts that it's some sort of failing that you have not. For this is a sermon about how it is perfectly all right to be incompetent for hours on end, because I am, and so is everyone I know. Even that famous jack-of-all-trades, master-of-nothing, Mr. George Plimpton, who in 1975 perfected the most spectacular firework ever, a Roman candle weighing 720 pounds. It was 40 inches long and designed to break the record for fireworks. It succeeded. Lighting it, Plimpton confidently predicted that it would go up over half a mile. In reality, it hissed, whistled, and finally blew a 10-foot crater in the earth. My friends, we, you and I, and everyone else, fail. Our self-sealing envelopes work best when we've forgotten to put the account number on the check. Our spilled drinks stain the only important papers on the whole desk. And our cat's hair adheres to everything but the cat's. We all look terrible for the first 72 hours after a haircut. In a classic shoe cartoon, little Skyler, his young nephew, sits at a desk pondering his recently returned test paper. And the caption says, "Churchill did badly at English. Einstein once flunked math. At the rate I'm going in Spanish, I'll be the next president of Mexico." One man who knows all of us failures very well is Stephen Broadbent, founder and first president of the Not Terribly Good Club of Great Britain. He was impeached in a later year when, at their annual banquet, he inadvertently stopped a soup tureen from falling over. Prowling through a bookstore in England one recent summer, I came upon Broadbent's marvelous Yearbook of the Club. It's a sort of reverse Guinness Book of World Records. Everything in Broadbent's book is true, verified, and witnessed, just like in Guinness. But Broadbent's book is of the least and the worst, not the most and the best. Like the least successful attempt to find the Loch Ness Monster. In 1985, four firemen from Hemel Hempstead tried to find the Loch Ness Monster by seducing it. Believing that feminine wiles would lure the beast from the deep, they built a 30-foot-long, blue-and-green, painted, papier-mâché female monster, equipped with long eyelashes and an outboard motor and a pre-recorded mating call. "Sex solves everything," said one of the firemen. The monster set off in search of romance with two firemen inside, steering. They traveled 15 miles, offering flirtation and mystery, but encountered only sustained hormonal indifference from the deep. Perhaps this was in part due to an outboard motor fault during the voyage that sent the monster into such a spin that it veered off backwards and crashed lengthwise across a jetty. Broadbent points out, no woman is at her best under such circumstances. Broadbent concludes that what human beings are best at is failure, incompetence. It is, he says, the quality that marks us off from the animals. He admits that the occasional Segovia does slip through the genetic net, and we line up for tickets to see him play the guitar flawlessly. In real life, however, all the rest of us spend hours replacing broken strings, and then people wish we hadn't. In 1978, workers were sent to remove the rubbish from the bottom of the Chesterfield Stockwith Canal. They worked half the morning and then took off for a tea break. They were interrupted mid-cup by a police officer who asked for their help in investigating a report on a giant whirlpool in the canal. When they got back, the whirlpool had gone, and so had the canal. There was just this long stretch of mud filled with old prams, tires, bicycles, and an army of irate holidaymakers stranded on hundreds of boats in a bed of brown sludge. Turns out that one of the first pieces of junk the workers removed was the 200-year-old plug that kept the water in the canal. Broadbent writes, "I am sure that I am not the only one who cannot do things, and the slightest investigation reveals that no one else can do anything either. This being the case, it seems to me that humanity spends a disproportionate amount of time talking about the things they do well, when these few blades of grass are surrounded by vast prairies of inadequacy, which are much more interesting." The residents of Bennett Court, an old folks' home in Otley, Yorkshire, ordered a fence around the home to give them more privacy. The city council sent a truck full of workers who took 5 days to put up a 12-foot-high, 100-yard-long fence. As they finished, they suddenly noticed that they had left no gap to drive their truck back out. "It was like watching a Laurel and Hardy film," said Mrs. Elizabeth Ann Whitaker, who watched it all from her upstairs window. "You could see them looking at the fence, then at the truck, then at the fence again. Some of us had wondered about the truck, but we didn't want to interfere." A city council spokesperson said it was an oversight. They'd gotten carried away with their work. The next day, the workers tore part of the fence down and retrieved their truck. As Murphy said in his 11th law, it is impossible to make anything foolproof because fools are so ingenious. We are all flawed. We all fail. How hard, then, to live in a culture that makes success, winning, so important. A friend watching the Rose Bowl parade this year noticed how we can't just watch lots of gorgeous floats. We have to award prizes to the best. And every band was introduced by listing the competitions it had won. We wouldn't listen to them till we knew that. The not-so-hidden implication of all of this? If you aren't first or best or most, then you probably aren't worth anything. We don't even listen to the big successes when they tell us we've got it all wrong. Walt Disney wrote, "Being a success has never helped me make another good picture or win the love of my daughter. It doesn't even seem to help keep fleas off our dog. And if being a success won't give me an advantage over a couple of fleas, then I guess there can't be that much to being a success after all." But we live in a culture that sets everybody up to be a loser in some artificial contest or other. And worse, this culture somehow communicates to us that having just one failure, a grade, a job, a mate, an election, short legs, thin hair, having just one failure means somehow that we are once and for all failures as human beings. Once a loser, always a loser. Loser equals failure, and failure is bad. But we all lose. We all fail. As Broadbent says, it's what we're best at. So what happens to us when we take those guaranteed failures and inadequacies, the ones we all have, and assume from them that we, maybe our whole families, are failures? We hurt. A lot. Shouldn't we be finding ways to prevent ourselves and, for heaven's sakes, our children from being sucked into this way of thinking? Dr. Kurt Richter of Johns Hopkins tells us of this experiment. Take any two rats. Hold one rat in your hand so firmly that no matter how valiantly he struggles, he can't escape. He'll finally give up struggling. Now throw that quiescent rat into a tank of warm water. He'll sink. He won't try to swim. He'll drown. He has learned that there's no point in struggling. Now throw the other rat in the water. That one has not learned that struggling is useless. That rat will swim to safety. When, where, and how did you learn to give up on certain things in your life? Is that knowledge valid, or could some of it be false? Could there be areas of your life where you assume that you will always be a failure, but it doesn't really have to be that way, any more than that rat needs to drown? You know the old maxim, you never know what you can do till you try. The opposite, I suspect, is at least equally true. You never try till you know what you can do. But don't we all tend to move towards areas of previous success and away from the areas where we didn't get it right? Well, that's not all bad. There's some good wisdom to learning when to give up. In some recent tests with school children, they were given a variety of problems. Some were real problems with correct answers, but some were fake problems, completely impossible and insoluble. The students considered below average, with usually poor grades, gave up right away, not only on the impossible problems, but also on the easy ones. Meanwhile, the good students, those with higher grades, popular with the teachers, from a good home, that sort of student, solved the problems, the simple problems right away, but then they kept plugging away at the impossible problems, on and on, getting more and more desperate, more and more frustrated. They had been taught so well to work hard and be persistent that they didn't know when to stop trying. Yet there are some things it is no good keeping on at. For instance, recurring decimals. You'll never get to the end. Some days you should, as Pierre Salinger said, quit while you're still behind. I know that I'm going against the tide in this. I know that we are surrounded in our culture by those who would tell us that failure is never necessary. There are books and even religions on the market today that tell us how to control absolutely everything and have a nothing but successful life. Think positive, concentrate, they say, and you can get everything you want. I know there's a danger to what I suggest. Accept failure? Aren't you just playing into the hands of those who've already chosen to make being a failure their big success in life? Those like Ashley Brilliant when he says, "The best thing about my lack of progress is that I can't fall back very far." How am I helping people whom life has made so frightened of happiness, of success, that they have learned to relish the power of being the most successful failure in the world? It's a form of power. You know, playing poor me. I know these dangers, but nothing is perfect, certainly not me. And this is something that, danger and all, I have to say, because there is so much failure in the world, in us, and we are so often so hard on each other and ourselves about it. We all fail, even when there is no payoff. In July 1978, bank employees at Sherman Oaks, California, outwitted a robber when they refused to accept his suspicious package. They watched in relief as the security guard chased him out of the bank. Outside, however, a bystander saw the would-be robber running out, assumed he had just robbed the bank, and gave chase. He tackled the robber. He left two bystanders sitting on him and carefully ran back into the bank with the package. Unfortunately, the package contained tear gas carefully timed to explode mid-robbery. It took over an hour to clear the bank of the gas. Sir Robert Watson Watt, the Scottish inventor of radar, while in Canada, made a speech about how to make discoveries, and he was arrested there for speeding, caught in a radar trap. He attached this to his ticket: "Pity Sir Robert Watson Watt, strange target of his radar plot, and thus, with others I could mention, a victim of his own invention." Sometimes, even doing our very best, we fail. In another cartoon, Pogo says, "We have faults which we have hardly used yet." As someone else says, what we need is more failure, not less, for learning from success just builds mental pride. It's learning from failure that builds mental health. Could it be that if we redefine those words, success and failure, we could learn to better manage our failures, failures we are probably going to have a lot of anyway? How about adopting Winston Churchill's definition? Success is the ability to go from failure to failure without losing enthusiasm. Or Robert Louis Stevenson's, our business in life is not to succeed, but to continue to fail in good spirits. How many barriers in your life might such a sentiment remove? If you don't need to be successful every minute, maybe you could try playing the piano, playing tennis, fighting City Hall over something that matters, or even working for a better world. Perhaps there's wisdom and joy in O.K. Chesterton's motto, "If a thing's worth doing, it's worth doing badly." Maybe Marge Piercy was right when she said, "It is better to wrestle with a bear and lose than with a sparrow and win." Enjoying failure might free us to try new things. We might even succeed at some of them. And we might even be helping evolution along as we go. Because there's good news from people who tell us that failure is not only okay, but it's actually necessary. The famous biology writer, Lewis Thomas, tells us that failure is built right into the life process through DNA. The capacity to blunder slightly, he writes, is the real marvel of DNA. The molecule of DNA was ordained from the beginning to make small mistakes, mistakes that led ultimately to the evolution of human beings. It is only the mistakes that ever lead to anything new and different. Without this capacity for error, he writes, we would still be anaerobic bacteria. There would be no music. Thomas then suggests that evolution might never have taken place if human beings had been in charge of the DNA molecule. We would have made one fatal mistake, he says. Our molecule would have been perfect. It never would have occurred to us, thinking as we do, that the thing had to make errors. If we were not provided with a knack of being wrong, he writes, we would never get anything useful done. The luckiest days in the laboratory are the days when someone makes a mistake that suddenly everybody learns from. No, failure is not always cute. Failure is not always gentle. Failure is not always okay. Some failures, like malfunctions on NASA shuttles, have no redeeming features. But for most of us, failure is inevitable and should not be the end of anything, not our trying and not our enjoyment of life. Perhaps we should let the following case history be our example. Can you name this man? Failed in business at age 22. He was then defeated for the legislature at 27, for speaker at 29, for elector at 31, and for Congress at 34. So far, so bad. After finally winning a congressional term at 37, he promptly lost the seat at 39, lost the Senate race at 46, and was nosed out for vice presidency at 47. He lost a second Senate race at 49. Would you hire this man? Who was he? Abraham Lincoln. The next election at age 51 made him the second youngest president ever. Think about him when you blow something in the week to come. And remember, in the freedom to fail, in the freedom to try something challenging and new, there is life. Let us rejoice and be glad in it.